Hi, everybody. My name is Bill. I'm an alcoholic. You know, I miss our Alapups. What happened to our Alapups? I guess they relapsed. For those of you that don't know, there were a dog or two that would come every week in the beginning. So, before I start, I would like to thank my two benefactors. Earlier today, I was sitting on my sofa watching the football game. And then when the game ended, like a little after 4, I got up and I went downstairs and I did the handouts. And then I left. And then every week before the meeting, I go to the Westfield Diner to have dinner. And then I come over here. And I was over at the Westfield Diner and I noticed some of the people, two ladies here that come to the meeting that also came in to eat there. That's the first time I saw them there. And after I finished eating, I realized it was about 6:15, and I had to get over here quickly, so I didn't finish what I was eating, and I boxed it up, and I reached into my pocket, and I had left my money and my credit cards and everything at home. So they paid for my dinner tonight. So
oh, wow.
I'm really, really grateful, because it was kind of funny and kind of embarrassing, and, you know. So thank you very much. Not to draw attention to you, but is this your first meeting?
No.
No? First time here?
Yeah.
And how much time do you have?
January 13th, 11th.
Fantastic.
Beautiful.
Very good.
Thank you. So we've been going through the big book. This is week 5 of 7, so tonight I'm going to do 10 and 11, and then next week I'll do 12, and then the week after that I'm going to have a meditation workshop. So that's sort of the next few weeks. And just a sort of transition from last week, I did 6 through 9, and now we're going to get into 10 and 11. There was one more thing I wanted to mention about 6 and 7 that I, for me is really important. And it's funny because even just today, somebody texted me with, there's this daily, I send out daily emails to over 1,000 people, just, you know, inspirational stuff, recovery stuff, history stuff, all of that. And there's there's many, many daily sort of email sources. And there's this one that's actually pretty good. It's called the Daily Om. Daily O-M, O-M, that's it. And the one for today talked exactly about what I'm about to talk about now in regard to character defects, and that is as we're coming out of 4 and 5, and we start to work with 6 and 7 on an ongoing basis, and then we start getting into 8 and 9. For me, how I try to help people with character defects is we need to make sure that we're describing the defects in its harshest terms. So in other words, like for instance, for most of my life, I was usually late. And I would always say to people, you know, I'm fashionably late. And I would always describe it that way. And, you know, it almost seems like, you know, you should be that way. You know, fashionably late sounds like it's something you should do. You know what I mean? Fashionably late, I'm fashionably late. And, fashionably late to parties and fashionably late to meetings and fashionably late, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, I got sober and, I didn't really look at it much. You know what I mean? Fashionably late. It didn't seem like a defect to me. You know what I mean? It seemed like almost something you should be doing. You know what I mean? And then I really love it when people can sort of just confront you with truth. You know what I mean? Like undeniable truth. And I was supposed to be driving somebody somewhere. And I said, you know, I'll pick you up and I'll drive you to wherever they had some kind of an appointment or something. And, you know, I was fashionably late and I made them late for their appointment, which was kind of important. You know what I mean? And, I didn't say anything about fashionably late, but he had heard me use that term previously. You know what I mean? And, you know, I brought him to the thing. He was a little bit late. It didn't, fortunately, it didn't seem to have that much of an effect on the situation. I don't remember what it was anymore. But when he came out and I was driving him back, he was sort of a little bit quiet, you know what I mean? Because he didn't really appreciate what I had just done. And when I dropped him off back at his house, he said, Bill, you know, it's not that you're sometimes fashionably late. It's that you're dishonest, inconsiderate, and selfish.
Ooh.
And That was the day that I stopped being fashionably late. Because I was using a term that wasn't offensive to me. But then as soon as he said, you know, you're inconsiderate, dishonest, and selfish, then all of a sudden it just didn't sit with me kindly anymore. You know what I mean? So, you know, I appreciate the extreme honesty, but, you know, something I think that's helpful that we can do for each other, not to rub things in our face, but, you know, if we're working with somebody or whatever, that we use as harsh a term as possible to describe our defects, because then and only then are they going to be offensive to us, you know, ultimately. And, you know, there's a reading that I use to describe this, which is actually really good. It says, sometimes our readiness to have character defects or moves depends on what we call them. If misnaming our defects makes them seem less defective, quote-unquote, we may be unable to see the damage they cause. If they seem to be causing no harm, why would we even ask our higher power to remove them from our lives? Let's take people-pleasing, for example. Doesn't really sound all that bad, does it? It just means that we're nice to people, right? Not quite. To put it bluntly, it means we're dishonest and manipulative. We lie about our feelings, our beliefs, and our needs, trying to soothe others into compliance with our wishes. Or perhaps we think we're easygoing, but does easygoing mean that we ignore our housework, avoid confrontations, and stay put in a comfortable rut? Then a better name for it would be laziness or procrastination, or maybe even fear. Many of us have trouble identifying our character defects. If this is the case for us, we can talk with our sponsor or our program friends. We clearly and honestly describe our behavior to them and ask for their help in identifying our defects. As time passes, we'll become progressively better able to identify our own character defects, calling them by their true names. So, kind of interesting. You know, for me, you know, it's sort of a deeper way of going about it, for lack of a better expression. Now, the thing about 8 and 9 I wanted to point out, I kind of went through, there's these workshops that I do that are 9 weeks long. This workshop is 7 weeks long, so this workshop was a little bit more spontaneous and a little bit less in the book. Normally I do a workshop that's very much in the book, and, you know, I get to go into this kind of stuff in a lot more detail. This time I just wanted to be sort of spontaneous. If you open your book, if you have one, you don't have to have one, but if you open your book in the sort of the middle of page 77, I just want to touch upon the categories that the big book touches upon in regard to making amends. If you notice the paragraph right in the middle of page 77, a couple lines down, it says, the question of how to approach a man we hated will arise. So that's the first category. The first category is people that we have issues with. People that, first of all, it says the man we had hated. Hated is past tense. That means we don't hate them anymore. Through the resentment inventory, we start to have a completely different attitude toward these people that we have resentments toward. So, and then it goes into great detail about what to say, what not to say, what to do and what not to do. But I just want to point out the different categories that are in step 9. Then in the middle of page 78, it talks about most alcoholics owe money. I would suggest that you cross off the word most and put the word all. I've had people say that they didn't owe any money, but I'm not interested in getting into an argument. Just change it, and I'm pretty sure it applies to everybody. And then at the bottom of that page, it says, perhaps we have committed a criminal offense, which might land us in jail if it was known to the authorities. So it talks about, you know, illegalities and the ways we harm people around that. And then in the middle of page 79, it says usually other people are involved. So it could be illegal stuff or maybe not illegal stuff, but, you know, harms that are done that involve other people. Also, it's not always necessarily, me and my friend went and robbed somebody, so now I'm going to try to make amends for that and another person is involved. Sometimes the way that another person is involved is, like, for instance, I had been sober for a few years, and then I was in a relationship with a girl, and then the two of us started getting into the step work for the first time out of the big book. As a matter of fact, it was her friends that turned me on to the big book. And I had stolen money from my parents' church. Imagine me doing that. I stole money from my parents' church. Now, when I started going through the steps, I always had in the back of my mind, you know, like, I stole from God, you know what I mean? Like, you know, like, this is like the worst karma you can imagine, you know what I mean? Like, and in my mind, I always said, you know, as soon as I start making amends, that's going to be one of the first ones I'm going to do, because, I mean, this is just so bad. I mean, I stole from God. You know, that year, it was like 95, January 95 was when I did my fourth and fifth step, and then March or April of 95 was when I was going around making amends. And that year, my parents were celebrating Easter because they're very religious. And I went up to see my family, and I was going around making amends to my family while I was up there that weekend. I was there for, you know, 3 days. And it was a really, really beautiful experience. And, you know, I calculated that I had stolen $1,500 from the church. And that year, and what a coincidence, that year I had a larger income tax refund than I was expecting. Other people were involved, so I had to go to my girlfriend and say, you know, listen, I want to take a big chunk of money and make some amends. And I know that we have bills together, and, you know, at the time I was making more money than she was. And, you know, I another person was involved in regard to my financial situation. So I needed to go to her to make sure it was okay for me to make the amends. And, of course, it was. And, you know, I went up there and paid the money back. And the cool thing was that the priest said to me, Bill, you know, the church is doing really well financially right now, and you don't need to give us this money. And there was a part of me that was like, yes! You know what I mean? And I found myself saying, against my wishes, my voice said the following words, "No, Father, you don't understand. I have to do this. I have to pay this money back." Mm-hmm. And, you know, a part of me was horrified by what I was saying, you know, because, like, I didn't have to do it, but yes, I do have to do it, you know what I mean? I took from the universe, so I have to give back to the universe. And sometimes it's not so direct as, you know, there were people I stole from, I didn't even know who they were, you know what I mean? Like, I was at a place and there were a bunch of jackets, and I closed the door and I took money out of the jackets and out of the pocketbooks. I don't even know who the people were. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I took from the universe, so I have to find a way to give back to the universe. Mm-hmm. If I can't do it, you know, sort of in a direct way, like if I know who the person was. Mm-hmm. So, and then on the bottom of page 80, it talks about, I love the phrasing here, the chances are that we have domestic trouble. Yeah, right, like, yeah, we might have problems at home, yeah. So this starts with the first problem at home that it discusses. And again, it says what to say, what not to say, what to do, what not to do, is infidelity. That's the first thing that's talked about. And then on the middle of page 82, it talks about if we have no such complication as in infidelity, there's plenty of harm that we need to make amends for at home. So the home one has sort of two categories. One is specifically infidelity, and then the second one is all the other ways that we harm people and the way we... Probably the worst way, some of the worst ways that we harm people that we live with is we're unreliable, we're dishonest, we steal their emotional security because they're never sure what we're going to do. That's sort of a really, you know, these are the people that we love. This is what we do to the people we love, you know what I mean? Like, it's really messed up, actually. It's we usually treat the people that we're closest with the worst. And, I mean, you know, there's some parts of our literature that really just smack us in the face with this, and it's like, you know, these are people that I loved and that loved me. This is how I treated them, you know. And then a little bit below the middle of page 83, it talks about, you know, there may be some wrongs that you can never fully right, and it's talking about, you know, people who have died or people who don't know where they are or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And it talks about, you know, we can write a letter. We can make amends for every single kind of a harm that we can cause. And with those, let's call it seven categories, it's interesting to me because I've never found an amend that doesn't fit into one of those categories. And then, like I said, this book on those pages go into great detail about what to do, what not to do, what to say, what not to say. And I think the reason why it goes into such great detail is because for the first time in our step work process, we're allowed to leave the house and interact with other people. So it goes into great detail about what to say, what not to say, what to do, what not to do, because, you know, this is like, you know, we're going out now, you know what I mean? Up until now, we were just at home. You know, my sponsor came, we read some stuff in the book, I wrote some stuff down, I shared it with him, I said a couple of prayers. Everything was sort of an internal kind of a thing, and now for the first time, going out. One last thing I'll say about amends, and I think I might have said it last week, is that by way of making amends, I'm not a big fan of the term "I'm sorry." I'm just not a big fan of the term because we spent our whole lives apologizing to people and never meaning it. And I remember one time my brother confronted me, and I don't know, I might have shared this last week, but it's coming now. As a matter of fact, it's strange because I was in White Plains, New York. I was walking down the street from my house right by North Street School, which is down the street from White Plains High School, and we were actually smoking a joint. And my brother turned to me that day, and he said to me, "Bill, you know, when you say you're sorry, that means you're not going to do it again." And I just remember looking at him like, whose theory is that? You know, like, I never said I was sorry because I wasn't going to do it again. I said I was sorry because I was trying to get myself out of a situation. You know what I mean? Like, I was just like, whose theory is that? That just seems, I've never meant that when I said I was sorry. You know what I mean? So, you know, personally, I'm just not a big fan of the "I'm sorry" way of amends. You know, we're not there to say we're sorry. We're not even necessarily there to get forgiveness. We're there to set right the wrong, period. The best description of the ninth step amends process is found on page 13, where it talks about Bill's story, and he says that I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability. That's the best description I've ever found on what the essence of amends means. I am to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability. I'm not there to fix the relationship. I'm there to set right the wrong. And if I attempt to set right the wrong and the person doesn't want to talk to me, that's the best that I can do. That amend has now been done. I have to respect their wishes. If they never want to talk to me again and that's their response to me making an approach to making amends, then I need to respect their wishes to never talk to them again. And it doesn't mean that, you know, there's not some kind of crossing of paths or whatever, but, the person saying that they don't want to hear from me. And if I try to force an amends on them, I am now going to have to make amends for that. Mm. And that's the worst kind of an amends. The worst kind of an amends is having to make amends for it later, the amends that we're making. So that's to be avoided by like the plague. And then we start getting into 10 and 11. As far as I'm concerned, 10 and 11 is kind of one step with two parts. 6 and 7 is one step with two parts. 8 and 9 is one step with two parts. 4 and 5 is one step with two parts. You know, it's really... I never used this term before, but I guess I would call it like a co-step. You know what I mean? Like, although I see all 12 steps as one step with 12 parts, you know, there's certain steps that sort of just go together. They're naturally attached. And 10 and 11 talks about how to start the day. It talks about a number of things throughout the day, and then it talks about how to end the day. So it's literally living in the day. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes we hear, I do my 10-step at night. Nowhere in the big book does it say that. What it says in the big book is, I do this as I go through my day. So, in other words, if... let me give you an example from my life. It was just after I had done my fifth step. And I just started seeing, you know, after you do your fifth step, you know, the hideousness of my life run on my terms is just in your face. It's just in your face. It's undeniable. It's a rude awakening. It's a harsh reality. It's a discovery of a harsh reality that wasn't there until you did your fourth and fifth step. It's really amazing. Nothing's changed, but all of a sudden everything has changed. And it's like, oh God, I just feel so dirty about me. You know what I mean? Like I'm so pathetic. I'm such a terrible person in the way I go about my life. And I remember my girlfriend or wife at the time. Let me refer to her as my future second ex-wife. That's what I'll call her. Everybody always gets a kick out of that. And that was only my second wife. She was off from work. But when I got up, I was working for AT&T, and you kind of get up early, do your stuff, and then you go to work. And she was off, but she had gotten up at the same time that I did, and she was doing something in the kitchen. And every time I tried to, I was a little bit late. And every time I was trying to get to the bathroom, she was sort of blocking me. And when I was trying to get out of the bathroom, she was sort of blocking me. And she was just pissing me off that morning. And I'm just like, hon, you don't even have to go to work today. Can you just kind of get out of my way? You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to be anywhere or do anything. Like, just kind of, I have to be somewhere. Mm. And, I was abrupt, you know what I mean? I didn't start the day nice. And, that was just after prayer and meditation. That's the interesting thing, That was how I was, moments after getting spiritual, And then when I was going to work, I was a little bit late. And, about three quarters of the way to work. I lived in the Netherlands. I worked in South Plainfield. So it wasn't very far. It was maybe 15 minutes, maybe 15, 20 minutes. And, three quarters of my way to work. And I mean no disrespect, but I have to describe it as I saw it. This elderly man with a hat came out and cut in front of me and then was going under the speed limit. You know what I mean? And I'm just like, get out of my way. Like, what are you doing? Like, and I don't think I was so nice to that guy. You know what I mean? He probably went most of the way as I was trying to go and then turned wherever he was supposed to turn. And then, I get to work at 8:30 or whatever it was, and then at 8:45, my boss needed something, done yesterday, and And it's like 10 o'clock, and I'm just like spitting bullets, Like I'm just, pissed. I'm just beside myself. And then it hit me. Like, when you put a decent-sized snowball on the top of a hill, and then you roll it down the hill and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. Well, my morning had just snowballed on me, And the momentum was building and it was going in no place that I would like to go, Like, it was just taking me down the hill. So at like 10 o'clock, all of a sudden it just hit me that, oh my God, This is my current situation. And I just sort of stepped back and I went within myself. And I got back on the beam, and I was able to go on with my day. And, I wasn't still, it was all behind me by the time lunch came. And, there were some other things that happened that day, but it was now not accumulating anymore. Whatever was happening was just happening, and I was just there with that, and I wasn't carrying. I called my girlfriend and said, sorry about how I treated you earlier. And, I said some prayers for that guy that he would, take a driving test or something. And, by lunchtime I was okay, And stuff happened and it wasn't accumulating anymore. And this is what is the essence of sort of what Step 10 is talking about, that as soon as we catch ourselves off the beam, we use 4 through 9 and a little bit of 10, 11, and 12 to get back on the beam again. That Step 10 is not to be done at night. As a matter of fact, in the big book, it talks about an evening review in Step 11, and it doesn't matter if you call it 10 or 11, as long as you're doing it. It doesn't matter what you call it. And the day ended up being much better than it could have been because, I can't speak for you, but I think I am. I don't just accumulate stuff for a couple hours. I accumulate stuff for a couple weeks and a couple months and a couple years. You know what I mean? Like, that was how my life always was. Was that, I was always on the edge of flipping out. You know what I mean? And when we use the steps and when we use what's talked about in 10 and 11, in 11 it has a really great description. It talks about that we pause when agitated or doubtful. And how I describe that in my workshops and even I'm going to do now is, I pause when agitated or doubtful. Agitated is way before pissed off. Doubtful is way before in deep doo-doo, you know what I mean? Like, what's talked about in 10 and 11 in a really extreme and specific way is just being completely present with what's going on right here and right now, noticing my emotions, Agitation is emotions, and doubt is mental capacity. So what the book talks about in 10 and 11 over and over and over again is, you know, where are my motives? You know, where am I getting off? As soon as I start to get off. You know, we have, I've been saying this pretty throughout the workshop that, you know, spirituality is really ultimately about, you know, I have an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other shoulder. And in any moment, which is the one that I'm listening to? And when I'm listening to the unhealthy voice, I can get right back on the beam again. I have the tools to deal with it immediately. And sometimes I'm not able to do it, and I can make a phone call and talk to my sponsor or somebody who's in my network. And sometimes, you know, I need adult supervision. You know what I mean? Like, I need help. I'm not seeing it. You know what I mean? I'm not seeing what my part in it is. I remember a friend of mine one time, they were talking to me about something, and they said, you know, I'm sure that I'm playing a part in this, but I'm not seeing it. And that's when what it mentions is step 10, which is interesting to me, is that it doesn't say that when we're off the beam, the first thing we do is we call our sponsor. What it says very specifically is, as soon as we find ourselves off the beam, what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to go in and ask for help from God. So for me, that's really, really important. I can't tell you how many times I've gotten phone calls from people, either that I'm working with or that I'm not working with, and they'll, you know, be in the middle of some tragic situation that had just snowballed on them, like they were having that snowball day, you know what I mean? And they started describing it to me, and I sort of interrupted them and said, you know, did you pray yet? They asked God for help with this. And they said no. And that's the moment that I hang up. Because they were supposed to do that before they called me. Like, I'm trying to teach them. See, as a sponsor, my goal ultimately is to be unnecessary. I get people hooked up with God and the steps. That's it. That's AA's goal, is God and the steps. That's it. I'm supposed to make myself as unnecessary as quickly as possible. That's called healthy sponsorship. I think sometimes I see too much in AA that we create a dependency with our sponsees. And I don't see that as healthy sponsorship. Sponsorship is not, you know, ego babysitting, and it's not drama management. It's hooking up with God in the steps and being aware with what's going on inside of us. Because you see, the first nine steps deal with the past. The first nine steps deal with the past entirely. Now, there's a whole bunch of tools in there to deal with the present also. But when we go through the steps sort of officially, for lack of a better expression, the first nine steps deal exclusively with the past. And then the last three steps deal exclusively with the present. And when we're dealing fully with the present, that creates the future we would want. That creates the wonderful and the contented future that we would want. Hey, sir, can you put your phone away, please? Thanks, man. So it's kind of interesting. There's lots of tools in 10 and 11. Me and a friend of mine actually one time were up at the Wilson House, and we did an entire weekend study of just step 10 and 11. There was like so much in there. It's absolutely unbelievable. Sometimes what I recommend with people that I work with is that you just read. 10 and 11 is four pages. It's three full pages and two half pages. It's a total of four pages. And it's a really nice way to start the day and just remind us of, you know, what to keep in mind as we go through our day. Something I always like talking about also is that you'll notice that step 4 talks about a moral inventory, and step 10 talks about a personal inventory. Because when we do the moral inventory is, well, I just realized I don't have any money to put in the basket. I'll put in two next week. Don't worry about it. I already owe you. And my benefactors. I already owe my benefactors. I'll just put in double next week.
Oh, my God.
A moral inventory is sort of like, let's say, like a relationship conduct inventory, all right? I'm not going to get into a whole morality thing. And then, but then what we discover in the fourth step and the fifth step is that it's not about them and it's not about outside at all. Every problem that we've ever had was created by our mind. and the story that we told ourselves. It's never what they do that's the problem. It's always what we tell ourselves about what they do that's the problem. This is like the most important thing. And we start to see that, you know, it's a total inside job. It's a total inside job. Exclusively and entirely. If we can be in touch with the way that we sabotage our lives on a daily basis, then and only then can we get free. So it shifts from a moral inventory. It shifts from focusing on the outside to focusing on the inside. What did I do or not do to create this? And what train of thought am I using that's creating this? Something I did or didn't do, or the train of thought that I'm choosing to look at what's going on? That's the point of problem. The problem is never outside of us. The problem is always and entirely inside of us. And the 12 and 12 has this really cool expression that says, you know, it's a spiritual axiom that any time we're upset, there's something wrong with us. And the thing that's wrong with us is that we're upset. It's real easy. You're upset. That means you screwed yourself. On the occasion of your behavior, I upset myself. That's it. That's what 10 and 11 is exclusively about, is being on the focus. And, you know, after I did, you know, this huge inventory and this huge sharing of the inventory, I've seen over and over again the way that my mind sabotages my peace and the way my mind sabotages my life. So I've gotten this huge, explosive overview of what it looks like and what it feels like when I'm listening to the wrong voice. And that's what I try to focus on when I feel that I've gotten off the beam in any moment of any day. And that's what 10 and 11 is kind of about. And 10 has sort of what I would call a reactive part of step 10 and a proactive part of step 10. The reactive part of step 10 says, you know, this thought, the ninth step promises end with, they will always materialize if we work for them. So it's talking about work. It's talking about being on top with what's going on. And then it says, this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we clean up the past. We have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness of having entered the world of the Spirit. We've entered the world of the Spirit. We're now consciously connected. The whole goal of the steps has just been revealed. We've entered the world of the Spirit. We only have one problem, and that's separation from the power. We only have one solution, and that's conscious contact with the power. And step 10 promises are saying that I am now connected with the power. The goal of the steps has now been achieved. Now I need to grow in understanding and effectiveness of being consciously connected with the Spirit. Conscious contact. It says, we vigorously commence this way as we clean up the past. We have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. We learned about that in step 4. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We don't demand that God remove it now. We at once ask God for help. So again, as soon as we notice this stuff, the first thing we do is we ask God for help. And that's sort of like 6 and 7. It says we discuss them with someone immediately, which is sort of like 5. We make amends quickly, which is like 8 and 9. And then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. It doesn't say we resolutely turn our thoughts to anybody. It says we have to turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Not because we want to help them, but because it's possible for help to happen. I don't know about you, but I've tried to help a whole lot of people that didn't want my help. And were more than, it became more than obvious pretty early on that, you know, they're just, you know, half measures. You know what I mean? Like, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's a sponsor for a person like that. But that sponsor for that person is not me. Because as far as I'm concerned, and I'll talk about this a little bit next week, or maybe I won't, is that when it comes to sponsorship, it always and only comes down to one thing. Is the person I'm working with willing to do anything? Are they showing me by their actions that they're desperate and they're willing to do anything? That's it. as a sponsor, that's all I do, is keep looking for the willingness. I don't care what they're saying. They can make all sorts of promises to me. They can say, yes, 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 I'll do this. Yes, 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 I'll do this. What they say never matters to me. All I do is I keep my eyes on their feet. Are they showing me by their actions that they're willing to do anything? Are they making step work a priority? And if they're not making step work a priority, I need to get the hell away from them as quickly as possible, because neither I nor anybody else can help them if they're not willing to help themselves. But if they are willing to do anything, if they show me by their actions that they're willing to do anything, and that, you know, when I say to them, do such and such and get back to me in 3 days, and they do such and such and they get back to me in 1 or 2 days, they're showing me by their actions that they're willing to do anything. There isn't anything I won't do to help a person like that. There isn't anything I won't do, because they're showing that they're willing to help themselves. I cannot love them more than they love themselves. And as a sponsor, I use exercises, I use step work, I use suggestions, and most of them are very sort of step and program related, and some of them are not. And if I catch somebody I'm working with and they say something like, oh, I'd never be willing to do that, that's the first thing I'm going to suggest that they do. And people hate me for it. But are they willing? Or are they desperate? You know what I mean? Like if you're in the ocean and you're drowning and somebody throws you a blue lifesaver with a rope on it, are you going to complain to them that, you know, you prefer the red one? You know, I don't, you know what I mean? Like, you don't care if it's blue or if it's pink or if it's, you know, tie-dyed. Right. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to desperately grab the thing because you're drowning. You see, another reason why I go about it this way is because I know and have seen throughout the years that it's psychologically battering to start the step work and stop in the middle of it. One of the worst things that you could possibly do to yourself is to start the step work and stop in the middle of it. It's psychologically abusive. So I try as early as possible to see, you know, where are they at with this. So in the beginning, I say to them, you know, I'll sit down with them and I'll tell them, you know, exactly what we're going to do. And, you know, if you're willing to do all that, I'm willing to work with you. And if you're not willing to do all of that, then I'm not willing to work with you, because I'm not willing to deal with all the problems that you're going to have because of the step work you're not willing to do. So I've never fired anybody as a sponsor. People have shown me by their actions that they're no longer willing to work with me. That's it. I don't fire anybody. There's somebody that used to come to this meeting. As soon as I leave here tonight, due to a bunch of stuff that's happened over the last few weeks, I'm going to be contacting them and saying, you know, listen, I don't like leaving stuff open-ended, and I don't like leaving stuff unsaid. You've shown me by your actions that you're not willing to go to any length, so please don't call me your sponsor anymore, and it would be better if you found somebody else to work with. Because I don't know about you, but, you know, for years, there were people out there that were telling people that I was their sponsor, and I hadn't talked to them in 2 years. So I just like being straightforward and no open ends, you know, not leaving things unsaid, you know, this is just how it is. Now, also in regard to 10 and 11 that I find very, very, very interesting, when me and Mike did that workshop on step 10 and 11 the whole weekend up at the Wilson House, you know, we really, really studied 10 and 11 out of the big book, and we really, really studied step 10 and 11 out of the 12 and 12, and we discovered this, and I don't know if any other part of the big book matches up so exactly with the 12 and 12, and this is what I found. In step 10 in the big book, it says this really short prayer. I call it the AA mantra. A mantra is a word or a phrase that's very spiritually powerful and that you would repeat over and over again. Like, for instance, there's a mantra I work with whenever I speak. And, you know, I'm not sure what's going on, but actually in the last week I've spoken 4 times. And I'm just like, I'm tired to hear my voice. Like, can somebody else please share? You know what I mean? And the mantra that I say whenever I speak is, you know, like, so I was speaking tonight at 6:30. So throughout the day today, probably like 100 times, I said over and over and over again, Lord, may I be of service. Lord, may I be of service. I'm not here for me. I'm here to be of service. That's why, you know, I've been giving everybody exercise to work with each week. Yeah, you know, Bill sounds interesting speaking at the meeting, but really this workshop is about the exercises. Did you take advantage of that? Am I looking for an answer? But I noticed that, you know, last week the exercise was to talk a lot less and to listen a lot more, and people were a lot more chatty tonight before the meeting started. The exercise was to speak less. Did we take advantage of that? That exercise is the single most profound exercise I've ever worked with. Did we take advantage of the exercise? And if you did, I'd like to hear some of your results, because I'm not talking about now. You know, I'm not here to just help people sound better at meetings. I'm trying to help people to have an experience with certain things. So have you worked with the exercises? That's the only reason why I'm here. But that's the mantra that I use whenever I speak. And this is the mantra that I found in 10 and 11. In step 10 in the big book, it says, "How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done." In step 11 in the big book, it says, "Thy will be done." In step 2 of the 12 and 12, it says, "Thy will be done." In step 3 of the 12 and 12, it says, "Thy will, not mine, be done." In step 10 in the 12 and 12, it says, "Not my will, but thine be done." In step 11 in the 12 and 12, it says, "Thy will, not mine, be done." As far as I'm concerned, that's the AA mantra. God's will, not mine, be done. And, you know, I don't think there's any other part of the two books, the big book and the 12 and 12, that have the same phraseology over and over and over again. So I think they were kind of trying to say something. They were giving a pretty big suggestion there. And at the end of, 11, it mentions it again. And in 10. Also, I know that this is sort of toward the end of the step process, so some of you are not necessarily there yet, quote unquote. And you know, I'm not a big fan of sort of skipping ahead. We can go through the steps pretty quickly. Within a few months, we can go through the steps. And so the stuff that's talked about, you know, that I'm talking about tonight, you know, it's to be worked with in conjunction with step 9, because it talks about that, you know, we do this as we clean up the past. As we clean up the past is step 9. So we start working with 10 and 11 as we clean up the past. So after we do our fourth and fifth step, we work with 6 and 7 on an ongoing basis, get immediately into 8 and 9. And as we start to make some amends, we also start working with 10 and 11. And it talks about, and so that's the, I just read to you what's the reactive part of step 10. That when I find myself off the beam, this is what I do. I use 4 through 9 and a little bit of 12 to get right back on the beam again. And then on the middle of page 85, it talks about the proactive part of step 10. Just after the 10-step promises, it says, in the middle of page 85, it says that it's easy to let up on a spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. Laurels are past achievements. So, you know, we think that whatever we did in the past is enough. No, it's not. This is a daily program of daily spiritual growth. It's easy to let up on a program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do. So that's this whole paragraph is a pretty heavy warning. We're headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. You know, the devil on my shoulder is a subtle foe. It's cunning, baffling, and powerful. It says, "I'm not cured of alcoholism. What I really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition." For those of you that don't know, a reprieve is the suspension of a death sentence. When the governor calls and says, don't put that guy on the electric chair, that's called a reprieve. The suspension of a death sentence. That's the extreme word that he used here. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual growth. So notice it says the maintenance of our spiritual growth. So it doesn't matter how much spiritual growth we've had. What matters are we growing from there? Mm. It doesn't matter where we are, like in a religion or in a spiritual group or whatever. What matters is, am I growing spiritually? No matter where I am I moving beyond that? And then notice what it says, and this is the proactive part of step 10. It says, notice the language too. He uses really extreme language. He says, every day is a day that we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. There's the AA mantra. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. I can exercise my willpower along this line. All I wish is the proper use of the will. That's the proactive part of step 10. So if I'm trying to implement God's will in all of my activities, I'm not going to find myself off the beam so much. So this is the proactive part of step 10. A lot of people describe step 10 as, 5 through 9. When I get off the beam, I get back on it again. But there's this whole piece that's really, really important. It's what I'm supposed to be doing on an ongoing basis. And one of the exercises I give people that I work with is, put together a list of every area of your life. Your relationship with your pets, your relationship with your girlfriend, your relationship with your kids, your relationship with your family, your relationship with your home group, your relationship with AA as a whole, your relationship at work, your relationship with your group that you work with, your relationship with perfect strangers, your relationship with sports that you do, your relationship with the groups that you're in, etc., etc. Your relationship with yourself, your relationship with God, your inner world, etc., etc. And just, put a bunch of areas of your life together like that. And then put a dash after it. What's God's will for you in regard to your relationship with your pets? What's God's will for you in relationship to your family? What's God's will for you in relationship to your financial situation? What's God's will for you in regard to using the internet? Good luck with that one. What's God's will for your relationship with your sponsor? What's God's will for you or your relationship with your sponsees? What's God's will for your relationship with your sexuality? Maybe you're not in a relationship. What's God's will for in your relationship using your TV and using your iPhone? Good luck with that one. There must be a iPhones Anonymous meeting. There must be. Phones are such an addiction nowadays. Right. You want to see how bad a phone addiction can be? Take it away from your kid. That kid will die in front of you if you remove that phone from them. Right? There's got to be a smartphone anonymous meeting somewhere, I swear to God. There has to be. And imagine what life will start looking like, around that, using an exercise like that. I just splashed myself. We'll call it baptism. And then it says, much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from him who has all knowledge and power. You see, we're finite human beings. We cannot know the big picture. But we can know that part that does, called higher power or God or whatever you want to call it. We can never know the big picture, but we can know the one that does. And that's kind of what's being described here. If I have carefully followed directions, the 12 steps, I have begun to sense the flow of his power, of his spirit into me. Now, it doesn't flow into me. God is always and already here. I've been saying that. That's, if you've only heard one thing that I've said here, this workshop, hear that. God is always and already here. You cannot be separated from God. So God doesn't flow into us. We tap into that part that's already there. And it says, to some extent, we have become God conscious. I've begun to develop this vital sixth sense. Vital means life-giving. Vital sixth sense. But we must go further, and that means more action. I mean, come on, I just did a whole bunch of stuff. Like, can you just give me a break? No. Because 10 and 11 kind of go together. So, you know what I mean? Like, these, we're moving along. We're moving along. There's time frames throughout this book. You know, the first step talks about, you know, at once. We have to go on. At once means immediately. That means action and more action. Step 11 talks about prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter. Better men are using it constantly. It works, one, if we have the proper attitude, and two, work at it. That, you know, God is the pilot and we're the co-pilot. That's the proper attitude. And work at it. Growing in conscious contact. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe that we can make some definite and invaluable suggestions. And then it talks about an evening review. Using 4 through 9 again and a little bit of 12. So the daily discipline in the beginning is one day at a time I try to not drink. So in the very, very beginning, don't drink and go to meetings is a really good 2-week suggestion. So in the very, very beginning, not drinking one day at a time is kind of how the one day at a time thing works, right? But then when we start getting into the steps and when we start getting into consciously connecting spiritually, let me describe it this way, and this is kind of how I usually describe it. That I have 26 years sober now. Let me be more correct. I have 26 and a half years sober now. I'm like a little child. No, I'm 5 and a half, you know what I mean? Like, I have 26 and a half years now. So there isn't anything that I have to do to not drink tomorrow. There isn't anything. I could murder somebody and probably still stay sober tomorrow, all right? But if I want to stay sober for the rest of my life, then on a daily basis, you better believe me, there's a whole bunch of stuff that I need to be doing, and that's what's being described here. Prayer, meditation, bringing honesty into our life. Integrity, being true to myself. Loving even when I think the person doesn't deserve it. And aren't there whole groups of people that don't deserve it, right? You know what I mean? Like, there's a whole political group that doesn't deserve love from me. You know what I mean? Like, I did good not saying which one it was. This is very good. This is very unusual for me. Because I have strong opinions. You probably haven't picked up on that yet. I have strong opinions. Isn't it interesting that in the first paragraph of the single most read piece of AA literature, which is How It Works. The How It Works reading is the most read piece of AA literature. Most meetings start with it. How It Works is the piece of AA literature that you're going to hear the most if you're in AA. All right? And 3 times in the first paragraph, it talks about the importance of honesty and even refers to it once as rigorous honesty. So, like, they know us so well that if we just hear honesty, oh, well, you know, it's like half-measured honesty. So now we need to describe it as rigorous honesty. They're not talking about your honesty. We're talking about a whole nother level of honesty. You know what I mean? We're not talking about, half-measured honesty. We're talking about, you know, honesty. Like, you know, what everybody else hears when they hear honesty, not what we hear when we hear honesty. You know what I mean? So he throws in there rigorous honesty, just to be succinct, you know? Is honesty a priority for me? There's a spiritual exercise to work with. Is honesty a priority for you? And you know what? You can't be honest with another person unless you're honest with yourself. And you know what? You can't love another person unless you love yourself. Now we're drifting into that's just impossible land because I don't love me. I don't even like me. When I first got here, I rejected a loving family because I couldn't love me. Because I was bad and I was wrong. I was capable of lots of bad things. It's totally an inside job. It's totally and exclusively an inside job. I can't be honest with somebody else unless I'm honest with me. Am I growing in honesty with myself? I cannot love another human being. It talks about it on page 164. I can't give away something that I don't have. I can't give to you something that I don't have for me. Am I growing in loving myself? Am I growing in cherishing myself? Am I growing in being true to myself? There is the most impossible thing for an alcoholic to do. Please, no, anything but that. I'll do anything but that. I can't do that. And here's a topic that you could bring at your next AA meeting. Recovery is about growing up. Who wants to do that? Nobody. All this stuff we argue with, but it's so, so important. It's so, so important. You can't move past it. You can't blow it off. It's got to be part of our recovery if we expect to not drink and be happy about it for the rest of our life. There's a whole bunch of stuff we have to be doing on a daily basis. And that's what one day at a time becomes. One day at a time, I have to be practicing forgiveness. One day at a time, I have to be practicing honesty. One day at a time, I have to be practicing love. I don't know about you, but these things just don't come naturally for me. They just don't come naturally for me. They still sometimes don't come naturally for me, and I talk like this constantly. The last thing I want to be is a hypocrite. But I fall short. I'm just a human being. But I think ultimately I want to please God, and I think that pleases God. Whether I'm able to do it or not, whether you're able to do it or not, I don't think matters. Just I have the willingness. And there's been, you know, like in when we drink, there's like a progression where it's getting worse. Now there's a progression where it's getting better. And I hope and I pray that that pleases God. Because right now, that's the best I got. I really, really try to make this a priority, but I'm still human. But are we trying? That's the question. Are we trying? Do we work with people even when we don't want to? Even when it's not convenient? Do we still reach out our hand? Do we still return the phone call? Do we still go on the commitment? So it talks about retiring at night, constructively reviewing our day, and using steps 4 through 12. You know, it talks about it. So it says, we constructively review our day. Where are we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Again, step 4. Do we owe an apology? There's 8 and 9. Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person? That's step 5, and that sentence right there slaps us in the face and says, no more secrets. Is there something that you should tell somebody else? And don't wait. The way that I describe it is that secrets are the dark room where negatives are developed.
Wow.
Is that just the coolest expression? Like, secrets are the dark room where negatives are developed. That saying was made for AA. That saying knows us very well. You know what I mean? That saying knows us very well. Because we're the king and queen of secrets. Is there something that we kept to ourselves that should be discussed with another person? At once, it says. Were we kind and loving toward all? Again, step 12. What could we have done better? The essence of 10, 11, and 12. Was I thinking of myself most of the time, or was I thinking of what I could do for others, of what I could pack into the stream of life? Thinking about me is a big part of my problem, and thinking about somebody else is a big part of my solution. Then it says I should be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. We don't beat ourselves up about this stuff. We see the truth and we respond to the truth. That's it. I don't necessarily like this language, but let me just use it. You know, when we do something that's off, let's call that wrong number one. But then when we create a story and beat ourselves up about doing that, now we're getting to wrong number 2, 3, 4, and 5. Now, you know, semantics, wrongs, right or wrongs, good or bad, it's all semantics. But we don't beat ourselves up when we see that there's something wrong. We see the truth, perhaps for the first time, and then now we can respond to the truth. Am I willing to see the truth? That's all that matters. And it says, after making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire which corrective measures should be taken, 6 and 7. And then in the original manuscript, the next line said, thus we keep clean as we live each day. So step 10 and 11 can be described as this. And I love this phrase, I've said it a million times. That if we put out our garbage promptly, our house doesn't stink. You homeowners will relate to that. If we put out our garbage promptly, the house doesn't stink. And I'm talking about the inner stuff. You know what I mean? I'm talking exclusively about the inner stuff. And then it says, on awakening, we ask God for help about the next 24 hours. I love this. And thinking about our day, we may face indecision. Yeah, we may face indecision. Like, yeah, yeah. So it tells us what to do about that. It talks about concluding the period of meditation with a prayer that we show all through the day what the next step is to be. It's that prayer. I might mention it here, but it's one of my favorite prayers. I don't know where I got it from. It just came to me one day. I was working with somebody, and I said, here, use this prayer. And after I said it, I was just like, wow, that prayer is really good. I've never heard it before. And the prayer was this. You know, God, I really, really want to do your will, but please make your will really obvious. Because you know what I mean? Like, I want to do God's will, but, you know, I don't know. Like, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, do I go out with that girl? Listen, I want to do God's will. Please make God's will really, really obvious. Which means now I need to keep my eyes open for the red flags. I don't go out with somebody because I'm sexually attracted with them. I go out with somebody because they match my relationship ideal. It's not about me. It's about God's plan for me. Should I take that job? Should I quit my job and go take the other job? God, please, I want to do your will, but please make your will really obvious. And you know what? If I'm not sure, then I don't do anything. That's the other hard one. If I'm not sure, I don't do anything. You know what I mean? Because he hasn't made it obvious yet. A really, really powerful prayer. And then it talks about that, you know, if circumstances warrant, we ask our wives and family and friends to join us in meditation. The Oxer group, which is where AA came from, used to have this phrase that more light comes through two windows than one. And prayer and meditation in groups is a very powerful experience. It's a very beautiful experience. And, you know, like I said, 2 weeks from tonight, I'm going to do a meditation workshop. So stay tuned. Mm-hmm. And then it says, as I go through my day, I pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. I constantly remind myself that I am no longer running the show, humbly saying to myself many times each day, thy will be done. And then it gives us the ninth step or the 11th step promises. So the 10th and 11th step talks about self-examination, meditation, and prayer. And this is what it says in the 12 and 12. There is a direct linkage among self-examination, meditation, and prayer. Taken separately, these practices can bring much relief and benefit, but when they are logically related and interwoven, the result is an unshakable foundation for life. Now and then, we may be granted a glimpse of that ultimate reality, which is God's kingdom, and we will be comforted and assured that our own destiny in that realm will be secure for so long as we try, however faultingly, to find and do the will of my Creator. How do I know if I'm doing God's will? Four absolutes. Can I be completely honest with anyone about what I'm about to do? If I can be... You know, I remember somebody said, it wasn't a sponsee of mine, it was just somebody that I knew, they felt that having sex with this newcomer was God's will for them. That's a pretty bold statement, right? They felt that this newcomer girl, having sex with her was God's will for her. So I said, okay, I says, do you mind if I give you a little test? And he goes, yeah. And I said, okay, the next four AA meetings you go to, I want you to stand up and I want you to tell everybody in the room what you're about to do. And he's like, no, I'm not going to do that. And I said, well, then maybe there's a part of you that knows that it's not right. If you can't tell everybody about it, and be completely honest, if there's some reason why you just know that you shouldn't do that, then there's a part of you that knows that something's wrong. Absolute unselfishness. If you can see that what you're about to do, there's nothing in it for you, there's no selfish motivations, then that's a good sign. That's probably God's will for you. Can you say that what you're about to do is absolutely loving to them and others? That's a really good sign that that's God's will for you. And then absolute purity. Purity is not just, you know, sexual stuff, but it's also pure motives. That, you know, am I doing this because I really want something out of it? Or am I just doing it because it's the right thing to do? Four absolutes are one of the greatest indicators of God's will in our life. But I want to close with this. That what I've seen in my life as the difference between God's will and my will, and this is really obvious. When you hear it, you're going to be like, yeah, I totally identify with that. And that is that my will usually starts out real easy and then gets hard. And God's will starts out real hard because we sort of disagree with it. We want to do something else. God's will starts out real hard, and because it's God's will, then it starts to get real easy. And that's another way you can tell the difference between God's will and your will. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you.